I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Friends, today on Change Surfer, I'm going to be playing a bit of a speech that I gave at a conference at Oxford University 2 weeks ago. The conference was called Tomorrow's People, the Challenges of Technologies for Life Extension and Enhancement. It was March 16th, I believe, I gave this speech. The conference was amazing. It was a conference full of very interesting talks, and they're all webcasts. So if you go to www.jamesmartininstitute.ox.ac.uk. You can listen to all the panel talks at any rate. There were some talks that weren't broadcast, but all the panel talks were broadcast, and there was a panel on cognitive enhancement and a very interesting panel on life extension. The life extension panel had IEET fellow Aubrey de Grey, who is the advocate of anti-aging medicine, along with one of his chief nemesises, Jay Olshansky, who actually came about face and started to endorse the notion of a massive investment, $3 billion investment in anti-aging medicine at that conference. And the cognitive enhancement talk by Nick Bostrom is extremely illuminating. And there were other talks about tissue engineering and robotics and all kinds of things. The talk I was asked to give was about human nature, and it really made me mad when I started to read about what people say about human nature and all the lame excuses that they give for not wanting to have human enhancement technologies on the basis of human nature. And so I gave quite a pugilistic speech at this conference, and you'll be able to tell that my tone is a little bit confrontational. When I got back from Oxford, I was searching around for different podcasts to listen to, and I found a podcast of a talk by Nigel Cameron, who's one of the chief bioconservative Christian activists out there. He's an anti-abortion activist, British guy, but lives in Chicago now and co-founded, along with the liberal feminist Lori Andrews, the group called Institute for Biotechnology and a Human Future, which is one of the chief organizations trying to build a left-right coalition of bioconservatives to oppose human enhancement technologies. And this is something that he said about me during a talk that he gave a year ago, just on the basis of having read my book.
James Hughes, one of the more unpleasant transhumanists around, one of the more pugilistic transhumanists, he could certainly do with a certain amount of augmentation to calm him down, it seems to me. You know, he grouped together, and you saw this on the slide, the people he calls bio-Luddites, you know. Well, bio-Luddites and proud. Bio-Luddites and proud. Bio-Luddites and proud. Pugilistic, pugilistic, pugilistic. James Hughes, James Hughes, James Hughes. He could certainly do with a certain amount of augmentation, augmentation, augmentation.
You can tell that when he eventually listens to the following speech, he may think, I'm even more pugilistic and even more in need of human enhancement. So here goes.
One of the few things that may be unique to Homo sapiens sapiens among all animals is our facility for creating abstract concepts. And one of the earliest abstract concepts was probably the idea that there are spirits in the human body, in animals, and in things. We imagine an abstract unity and continuity to bareness, mountainness, and the human soul. These concepts are useful and allow us to make predictions about how creatures and things of a kind behave. But they also trap us in depositing identities that do not exist, of making inaccurate predictions and persisting with dysfunctional and limiting beliefs. Human nature is one such limiting, dysfunctional, illusory, inaccurate belief, the inadequacy of which is revealed in the debates over the moral uses of human enhancement technologies. Take, for instance, Leon Cass's grounding of his opposition to human enhancement in the existence of a platonic, unitary, and inviolate human nature. Species have specified natures, including cockroaches and humans, and to make a man into a cockroach or a post-human is therefore a violation of that nature. But when exactly does a man's evolution into a cockroach violate that nature? Is it the loss of a skeleton, the growth of the carapace, the hairy legs, the compound eyes? Can I have tiny antennae but not big ones? Is it the obsessive compulsion with the scent of food? Few proponents of a distinctive and unitary human nature attempt to answer these questions because they do not have a clear definition of human nature to begin with. Despite thousands of years of investigation and intimate access to the subject of investigation, there is no agreement about what human nature is. Are we innately good, compassionate, or evil and sinful, or a blank slate, or inscribed with all of our personality traits at birth? Is it human-specific cognition, language, tool use, or does it include physiology that we share with other species, such as mortality, emotions, altruism? Neuroscience and evolutionary psychology are specifying the exact structure and epidemiology of human cognitive traits and clarifying which capacities and impulses are genetically innate and which are plastic and learned. These findings have given succor to the advocates of human nature. Of course, there are myriad genetic features that shape our thoughts and behavior, some of which we share with most other human beings. But this constellation of influences fails as a theory of human nature on both analytical and normative grounds. It fails analytically because it posits a vague constellation of species-typical traits, which have no clear beginning, are not actually species-specific, and are not clearly threatened by any specific enhancement. And it fails normatively because the argument fails because we are not bound by our genes. There is no clear beginning for human nature or the human species. There was, we can assume, no day when all our hominid precursors gave birth to modern humans with opposable thumbs, hidden estrus, upright posture, language ability, abstract cognition, and tool use. These traits may have emerged abruptly in evolutionary time, but the periods were still tens or hundreds or millions of years. Which grandmothers or grandfathers were the defenders of human nature, determined finally had it, and were not just savage beasts like their parents? Well, our branch of the evolutionary tree shows continuous change right up through the last 15,000 years. Without specifying which traits confer membership in humanity, it's not clear whether our genetic differences from Pleistocene man mean we share human nature with him or not. Similarly, we share with primates almost all the qualities that allegedly make us special: self-awareness, culture, language, and tool use. No, primates aren't good at abstract reasoning or grammar. But then neither are small children, the demented, or the developmentally delayed, and yet they apparently have human nature. Accepting that the things we value and attribute to human nature are actually shared continuously with non-human ancestors and contemporaneous species is not a devaluation of those traits or of humanity. In fact, it is only by affirming the value of reason, language, compassion, and culture making that we can begin an ethical framework to guide human enhancement technologies. Without a clear definition of human nature or specification of the things of value, the opponents of human enhancement technology flounder in defining which enhancements cross the line. Fukuyama and the President's Council see the line being crossed with Ritalin, antidepressants, and pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, while others focus further along the line on the advent of superintelligent immortals and human-animal hybrids. But even if we did have some clear set of evolved traits that were distinctively human and aligned to cross, they are not normatively binding on us. To the extent that we are born with impulses for aggression and racism or selfishness, or limits on our capacity for wisdom, awe, or compassionate action, we may in fact be morally obliged to modify human nature. The boldest and most interesting defense, for me, of the naturalistic fallacy of a morally binding human nature comes from Francis Fukuyama. Fukuyama argues that human rights and solidarity are grounded in our shared human nature. Any effort to tinker with human nature erodes social solidarity and leads to totalitarianism. But he explicitly refuses to define human nature, calling it simply factor X. It isn't anything in particular, he says, but all these qualities coming together in a human whole that make up factor X. And this is very convenient, this ineffable gestalt. Because if human nature were the sum of features, rather than their irreducible whole, then they might be individually improved, and human nature with them. If human nature was self-awareness, empathy, and abstract thought, for instance, then a green-skinned, four-armed, transgenic could still be part of the Jeffersonian polity, and a superior citizen if she was smarter and more empathetic. But Fukuyama's factor X is also a unique argument that the diversity of humanity must stay within its existing standard deviations from the mean of human traits. Variation in intelligence, longevity, or morphology are okay, so long as we stay within these parameters. Although our social unity can apparently still encompass conjoined twins, amputees, people born with fur or tails, and the developmentally delayed and mentally ill, too many kids on Ritalin and 130-year-olds would apparently break the bell-curved social contract. But if people 4 feet tall can solidarize with people 7 feet tall, why can't the average person be 6 feet tall instead of 5.5? Why would having everyone enjoy the happiness or intelligence experienced by the luckiest 1% fracture humanity into racial subgroups? Certainly, the sudden adoption by a minority of superintelligence and immortality would challenge shared citizenship, just as shared citizenship has to be forged across gulfs of inequality in our society. But human enhancement poses no challenge to Fukuyama's normative standard. If most members of society become intelligent, long-lived, and beautiful, and gradually move the bell curve to the right. Nonetheless, for Fukuyama and the bioconservatives, this blurring of the line between ur-human and post-human is as horrifying as the emergence of an entirely separate post-human species. Since all good flows from the people of our race sharing pure factor X, and race pride in the goodness of our shared factor X must be protected from the complexities of a multiracial society, and even more from race-mixing contamination. The use of the concept of human nature today is, we see, inescapably human racist, with the same consequences for tyranny, violence, and suppression of human diversity as previous racial discourses. The human races are certainly more inclusive than their forebears, but they are racist nonetheless in their effort to ground solidarity in biological characteristics instead of shared recognition that other beings have self-awareness, feelings, and thoughts like our own. We hear in the panic demands to ban the mixing of human and animal DNA, striking echoes of the demands to protect the purity of the race from mongrelization. President Bush called for a ban on human-animal hybrids in his 2006 State of the Union message, and Missouri has become the first U.S. state to consider a ban on human-animal hybrids, cloning, human genetic modification, and explicitly transhumanism. The root of this racialist anxiety was laid bare in Mary Douglas's work. It is the taboo on the violation of categories, the blurring of lines between male and female, white and black, animal and man and God. The irony is that human racism is being promoted by some precisely as a means to unify humanity through species consciousness, just as white American identity was used to meld together Poles, Irish and Italians, and pan-Arabism and pan-Africanism to transcend nationalism and tribalism. The doctrine of a unifying human nature has become an unquestioned assumption in human rights discourse, such as in the Declaration on the Human Genome and Human Rights, which says that the human genome underlies our fundamental unity, inherent dignity, and diversity. As in previous racial discourse, human races pose scary scenarios of the deformities and monsters that this race mixing will create. The demonized other will dominate our social institutions and displace the rightful owners of their jobs and their seats at schools. If racial purity is the basis of racial unity, then racial impurity must be racial treason. George Annis and Laurie Andrews have been working with an international network towards a global treaty to make human genetic modification a crime against humanity. Annis justifies the suppression of post-humanity on the grounds that they are destined to engage in a race war, to enslave or exterminate pure humans. Therefore, species-altering genetic engineering is genetic genocide and a weapon of mass destruction. Is it mere hyperbole to point to the similarity between the race war apocalypticism of older racial discourse and that of the bioconservatives? Unfortunately not. Beyond the violence that would be done to human life, longevity, and well-being by attempts to ban modification of our chimerical human nature, there is the actual violence that apocalyptic human racism has already generated and will generate. Ted Kaczynski, a.k.a. the Unabomber, waged a bombing campaign for 18 years in the United States against scientists engaged in projects that he thought threatened human nature, principally through cybernetics and genetic engineering. Bombers of abortion clinics are also soldiers in the human racist effort. In the embryo rights belief system, all bearers of the human genome have equal moral worth, just as only bearers of this human genome have moral worth. The Christian Rights Manifesto on Biotechnology and Human Dignity, which calls for a ban on human genetic modification, makes clear the link that they see between the defense of the unborn and bans on enhancement. Human nature is unique and indivisible from conception to death. In conclusion, I am not arguing for a laissez-faire approach to human enhancement, unfettered by moral analysis and political regulation. It would be immoral and perhaps suicidal for liberal democracies to be indifferent to the directions in which personalities might evolve using enhancement. But the concept of a unitary and inviolate human nature is fundamentally the wrong place to start in the analysis of which aspects of human life we want to preserve, suppress, or extend. Rather, we need to make clear that it is our capacities for consciousness, feeling, reason, communication, growth, empathy, all of which we share to a greater or lesser extent with other animals, which we are willing to use our technologies and the agencies of our collective suasion to encourage. It is greed, hatred, ignorance, violence, sickness, and death which we wish to discourage, whether part of human nature or not. Yes, as a part of that project, we must take account of the neuroscience and the evolutionary psychology, even if the efforts to mold them into a natural law is wrong-headed. We must understand our genetic constitution if we wish to successfully improve it. But improve it, we should. As Peter Singer says in A Darwinian Left, we do not know yet to what extent our capacity to reason can in the long run take us beyond the conventional Darwinian constraints on the degree of altruism that a society may be able to foster. I hope with universal access to human enhancement technologies, we will soon find out. Thank you.
Sorry about all the percussives, but I didn't think I wanted to re-record it because I brought so much passion to it the first time. You know, first time's always the best time. But at any rate, that was my speech at the James Martin Institute conference on the Tomorrow's People, a conference on life extension technologies and human enhancement. That was March 14th to March 17th, and my talk was on March 16th. You can listen to my talk and all the other talks at www.martininstitute.ox.ac.uk. And as I said, there's the talks there by Aubrey de Grey and Nick Bostrom and other people. Also, at that conference, I unveiled what I consider to be some of the new techno-progressive policy priorities, which includes the effort to create a new techno-citizenship model, the notion of expanded scientific and technological literacy for citizenship, multinational anti-aging research initiatives, which could combat the old age pensioner crisis that we're facing, the fight against DNA patenting, or at least human DNA patenting, which I consider to be both an impediment to genetic research and also a violation of the very foundation of patent law, and a reform of the FDA testing regime so that we can ensure that drugs and devices actually are safe. And so in the spirit of actually being a techno-progressive critic of biotechnology as well as a proponent of human enhancement technologies, I give you now the Billionaires for Bush My DNA.
Come and choose a career. I said, young man, Why, there's nothing to fear, I said, young man. You can come study here in the finest laboratory genomes. We are mapping them now, we do farming. Look, we just cloned a cow, we keep secrets. And we won't tell you how, all our work is bought and paid for. I've got the patent, so it's my DNA. If they've got money, they can buy DNA. Since we're footing the bill, we can keep what we kill, 'cause that's the American way. I own your research, so it's my DNA. If you don't like it, you've got nothing to say. We're enriching ourselves while we're stocking your shelves, 'cause that's the American way. Research. Look, a rabbit with wings, we do research. And the lemon that sings, so much research. There are so many things you can modify in nature markets. What it's really about, our investors, why we're rushing things out to the public, whom we cannot let doubt that our goods are good for them. I've got the patent, so it's mine.
DNA.
If they've got money, they can buy
DNA.
Since we're footing the bill, we can keep what we kill, 'cause that's the American way. I own your research, so it's my DNA. If you don't like it, you got nothing to say. We're enriching ourselves while we're stocking your shelves, 'cause that's the American way.
That was My DNA by Billionaires for Bush. And now, if I may be a little bit self-indulgent, and hey, it's changed it for radio, when am I not being self-indulgent? My daughter, Althea Bach Hughes, last year entered, she was 11 last year, she's 12 this year, she entered the state history competition in the category of individual documentary film. And last year she made a film about Rosie the Riveter, the image, the films about her, the myth about Rosie the Riveter during World War II as a way to encourage women to take the place of men in the factories and the lasting effect that it had on women's employment and women's self-image. And that documentary that she made won third place in the state in that category and first place for Women's History Prize that she got, and inspired her to again enter the state history competition. And this year she came in again first in the regional competition a couple weeks ago. And she's going on to the state. So I'm going to give out a little daddy love to and play a little bit of the audio from this year's documentary film, which is about Ohio station masters on the Underground Railroad and their formative role in setting the stage for the Civil War. And here's my daughter, Althea Bach Hughes.
One of the most famous routes on the Underground Railroad led through the border town of Ripley, Ohio. Almost all the residents of Ripley were abolitionists who helped escape slaves. Presbyterian minister John Rankin was one of the most famous station masters in Ripley. A light in Reverend Rankin's window was a beacon of hope for slaves who were able to escape across the Ohio River. Harriet Beecher Stowe was another important contributor to the Underground Railroad while she was living in Ohio. Stowe lived in Cincinnati between 1832 and 1850, and while there she met with John Rankin and other Ohio abolitionists. Her book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, written in 1852, movingly described the plight of slaves and the struggles of the fugitives. It was based on stories she had heard in Ohio, and it helped build sympathy among the northern whites for the abolition of slavery. One of the passages in Uncle Tom's Cabin is about an escaped slave named Eliza who wades across the Ohio River with her baby in her arms. She brought the struggles of slavery and the terrors of running away into the homes of the northern whites. When Abraham Lincoln first met Stowe, he was reported to have said, "So this is the little lady who started this big war." Another famous station master and conductor on the Underground Railroad in Ripley was the escaped slave and blacksmith named John Parker. Every night, he secretly crossed the Ohio River into slave-owning Kentucky to find escaped slaves and bring them across to freedom in Ripley. From 1822 to 1863, the town of Ripley sheltered more than 2,000 escaped slaves. John Parker later invented and patented machines to harvest cotton which replaced slaves in the fields. He valued education and was known to have said that if any one of his children followed in his profession and became blacksmiths, he would disown them. Parker sent two of his six children to Oberlin College. Oberlin, Ohio was another important site of abolitionism and a stop on the Underground Railroad. John Brown, one of the most famous and radical abolitionists, also lived in Ohio at one time. Both Brown and his father were active station masters on the Underground Railroad, and Brown's father was a trustee of Oberlin College. Brown believed abolitionists should do more than help slaves one by one to freedom, but that slaves should revolt against their masters. On October 16, 1859, Brown and two dozen committed followers, including many Ohio abolitionists and some veterans of the Wellington Rescue, attempted to start a slave revolt at Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, by seizing a federal weapons arsenal. In retrospect, the station masters and the abolitionist movement in Ohio played a key role in forcing the United States toward a final end to slavery by keeping the injustice of slavery before the nation. On April 12, 1861, the new Confederacy of the Southern States attacked Fort Sumter. By the end of the war, more than 500,000 Americans were casualties of the conflict. But the South would not back down, and they would not give up their slaves. So, in the middle of the war, on January 1, 1863, President Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing all slaves in territories held by the Confederates. Although Lincoln had no power to free slaves in the rebellious Confederacy, his declaration encouraged Southern slaves to escape and enlist in the black regiments of the Union and fight to defeat the Confederacy. After the war, on December 6, 1865, slavery was finally abolished with the ratification of the 13th Amendment of the Constitution. The courage, ingenuity, and honor of the station masters and conductors of the Underground Railroad continue to inspire people to stand up for their beliefs today.
Again, that was my daughter, Althea Bach Hughes, from her documentary on the Ohio station masters on the Underground Railroad. See you next week on Change Surfer Radio. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.